Thanks so much for being here with us again, Eric.
Great to be back.
Well, I'm really excited that you have a new book out. I love your work. I use both your books in my classes. I teach them. My students really respond to them. So tell folks out there listening about the new book, just whatever you want them to know about it.
I guess it's a little different from the other two in that it's more of a hopeful book as opposed to Lost Mountain, which was a deeply depressing book. But I've been reading about utopian communities for about 20 years. And so I just sort of had this realization a couple years ago that the country is headed in the wrong way. We have this huge income gap. We live in completely unsustainable ways. We have a financial industry that's taken over our politicians. And so I just started thinking really seriously about other ways that people have lived in the United States. And I realized that what I was really thinking about was these utopian communities that have always fascinated me for two decades. And so I just decided, you know, why not just take a road trip and drive through them and sort of look and just think about what they represented, what can be salvaged from those radical idealists. And so that was in a lot of ways what kind of sort of set me on the trip.
So did you do that in all one fell swoop, or did you do lots of road trips over the course of a long time? Or
yeah, I did. I did it in one fell swoop. It was a 2-week intense drive that started right outside my back door, really, in Shakertown, and went through Gethsemane, then into Indiana, then back through Virginia, and then up north, finished in Oneida, New York, where there was a free love community up there called the Perfectionists. So when I got to upstate New York, I was exhausted, but I had met a lot of really interesting people, accumulated a lot of great stories.
So how many did you end up visiting? How many communities?
There's 8 communities in the book.
And there's I haven't been able to read the book yet. I can't wait to get it. I'm waiting until you do your book signing here in Lexington so I can go and get it signed and get my copy that way. I hope everybody else will too. But I did read the excerpt that was published in The Atlantic. And in that short piece, I learned so much that I didn't know about utopian communities. For example, in there you write that although people don't think of utopian communities really existing anymore, there are a lot of them in the United States, right?
How many? Yeah, there really are. They don't call themselves utopian anymore. They call themselves egalitarian. Mm-hmm. But they're built on exactly the same principles. And so there's hundreds of them still going in this country. Some of them are very, very small. But like the one that you read about, Twin Oaks and Louisa, Virginia, it's just a great example. I mean, they started in 1967, the year I was born, Summer of Love, and they've been going ever since. And they are completely worker-owned cooperative, and they just have this really beautiful sort of... I mean, the great thing about utopianism is it's an act of the imagination, right? You know, you have to imagine utopia. And then you can just, you know, you can write a utopian novel. This is the 500th anniversary, actually, of Thomas More's novel Utopia. Or you can actually take it a step further and enact that vision, you know, in the real world, in a landscape that you alter. And so that's what fascinated me about all the utopian communities, really, but especially Twin Oaks, because it's still going.
Why do you think they reject that label of utopian community? What's wrong with that phrasing for them?
I think it probably just sounds too archaic. It sounds like something from the 17th century,
right?
Whereas egalitarian sounds like a contemporary example of socialism.
Do you think people have a lot of stereotypes about these kinds of communities? And if so, what are they?
I think the main stereotype is that they're cults. And they're not cults. They do separate themselves from the mainstream society, mainly because they've been so abused by the mainstream society. The Shakers here in Kentucky were, you know, mercilessly abused by the people of Harrodsburg. And so they just felt the need to separate themselves off. But I think another thing that's important is they're trying to create models that are examples of a completely different kind of economy, a completely different way of organizing a community, where capital is really social capital. It's not financial capital, you know, or natural capital. And so I think what a lot of these communities are trying to do is they're trying to say, hey, you know, this can work. This can still work. And it can usually only work on a very small, decentralized level where it doesn't get abused. But, you know, Wendell Berry's been talking about those kinds of communities for 50 years in this state. So we should be used to some of that kind of talk.
Mm-hmm. Have they stayed about steadily the same since, you know, they came into being so much in the 60s? In that, you know, last 50 years, have they been pretty steady or have they dropped off? Or
I think there's been a real sort of boom and bust cycle mm-hmm. with them. People come and go. The interesting thing about Twin Oaks is that they settled on an industry, a hammock industry, and it's been a very stable form of funding for them. And so that's let them kind of stabilize. The members are a little bit older, so it's not just, you know, college kids coming and going, and so they've built a little bit more community. But if you look back at the 19th century, from 1930 to 1950, there were 200 utopian communities in this country. Hmm. So it's an American movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like a European kind of revolutionary or a Russian revolutionary where the notion is like you take out the powers that be violently. Here it's been a real quiet revolution where, you know, these communities just said, you know, we're going to step outside of the mainstream and we're going to show you how something, you know, based on very, I mean, biblical really principles of sharing and egalitarianism can be effective. So one of the myths is that utopian communities don't last, but the Shakers lasted for 100 years and the Oneidan perfectionists lasted for almost 100 years. It was really just the Civil War and, you know, this larger schism in the country that brought them to an end. So one of the things I want to say in the book is that these are enduring values. With the 19th century utopianists, they tended to have real flamboyant religious leaders like Mother Ann Lee of the Shakers. And they took really seriously the passage in the book of Acts that said the first Christians held all property in common. And so in many ways, they were the true Christians, which I think is one thing that people in Harrodsburg sort of resented about them. Now you look at at communities like Twin Oaks, and they've sort of shed that religious mm-hmm. religious attitude, but they're still very grounded in these ideas of no exploitation, no sexism, no racism, mm-hmm. sharing worker ownership, you know, all these things that really existed in the early 19th century communities.
So even the ones that no longer have a real religious foundation would still have a really structured value system, I guess.
One of the people I interviewed, a woman named Valerie at Twin Oaks, said that, you know, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to live our values.
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me about her and the people I met there is that they live their values far more consistently than I do, mm-hmm. or than most people I know. They make very, very important decisions about how to avoid the kind of cruelty and violence and exploitation and inequality that pretty much defines contemporary American life.
Of the eight communities you looked at, then obviously Shakertown is no longer operating, but how many of the eight are still, you know, still working communities?
There were the two that I visited in Virginia. The interesting thing about Louisa County, Virginia, is that the zoning laws there are so lax that you can drop 100 hippies on a farm and nobody cares. So mm-hmm. it's very conducive to forming these kinds of communities.
Right.
And I think they've earned the respect of the farmers around them. I think, you know, people mm-hmm. see that they're very serious individuals.
So then Gethsemane is still operating, but not in that same definition, right? Or how does that work?
Yeah, Gethsemane is interesting. I mean, it obviously is a a tight-knit community of people who share common values. And so on that level, it definitely would fit inside some definitions of utopianism. What I found really interesting about Gethsemane was that in the book, I imagined this metaphorical compass, and the four points were along one axis, the utopia of escape and the utopia of reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And then on the other axis was the utopia of solitude and the utopia of solidarity. And so I saw these four tensions working throughout my trip. But what fascinated me about Gethsemane was that Thomas Merton in some ways embodied all of these things. He wanted community so bad, but he wanted to be alone so bad. He wanted the idea of a utopia of reconstruction, but he also just wanted to withdraw further and further. Mm-hmm. So I kind of used Merton's experience as a monk to think about those things.
Right. Well, that's one thing I have thought a lot about since I read your piece in The Atlantic is, you know, I mean, during this election and all the terrible things that have been happening in the country, it feels like we've just been pummeled here lately. And this culture of vitriol that we're living so much more in, it seems like, than we used to, that's enough to make anybody want to run off, right? And live in this kind of community. But I'm not being completely accurate in saying that, right? I'm sort of stereotyping them in that way. Or is this sort of what lead people to these communities?
I think a lot of the people that I met, it was a sense of disillusionment, mm-hmm. Particularly after the financial crisis, that they no longer wanted to participate, say, in Occupy Wall Street. They didn't want to fight the system anymore. They wanted to go someplace and reinvent a whole new system or be part of a system that existed completely outside of a corrupt system. And, you know, I would ask them about that. I would say, you know, do you feel like this is escapist? And they would say, well, yeah, but the suburbs are escapist. So I think they had this notion that they are creating a kind of model that would be useful if we would pay attention to it. And they're obviously living out a value system that would be useful if we paid attention to it, which I think is why Bernie Sanders resonated so much with so many people. Is Sanders was talking very, very, in very similar terms about the same kinds of principles of the people I interviewed. And so I think that's important to remember, that there's a huge portion of the you know, populace out there that, you know, isn't driven by vitriol, but is driven by this sense that, you know, things could be better than they are.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're listening to Hillbilly Solid here on WUKY 91.3. We're visiting with Eric Reese, author of, most recently, Utopia Drive. Well, obviously, you went on this long car drive, you know, this long physical journey. Not to get too corny, but what about the emotional journey that you went on in writing? I mean, every writing of a book is a huge emotional journey. So can you talk about what you learned about yourself from writing this book?
One thing I learned about myself was that I couldn't belong to these communities, that I veer more towards the utopia of solitude than the utopia of solidarity. The Shakers slept six to a room. There was very little privacy, which is one of the reasons I included a chapter on Walden in the book, because I wanted to dramatize what a utopia of solidarity looks like. So I think ultimately I realized that a lot of these communities embodied my values better than I do. Mm-hmm. But I also learned that, you know, just, you know, if I'm being honest with myself, I'm not that much of a joiner. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I learned, you know, I talk to people like a community in the Berkshires where they've invented their own local currency, and they've invented their own loan programs. They're carving out a whole economy that exists outside the financial industry and in some ways would subvert the financial industry. And that's what's interesting about utopian thinking is it thinks inside the gaps, inside the cracks, and it says we don't have to wait for our legislators to find a moral compass. You know, there's things we can do now that there's things we can go out and do now that will both make things better for people in the community and will be a model for what should be done on a larger scale. So there was a real hopeful takeaway on that level. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there are these things that can be done, and it's not as if you're attacking a corporation or an industry head on. What you're doing is you're saying we're going to live in such a way that that industry or that corporation is going to become irrelevant to the culture. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what's really interesting about a lot of these utopian thinkers.
Right. Well, the one in Virginia, is it Two Rivers?
Twin Oaks.
Twin Oaks.
Yeah. Two Rivers would be a good name for a utopian community.
Right. Well, I remember in that Atlantic piece, one thing that sort of comes up that I found really interesting and I'm expecting you to go more into in the book is this idea of how do you have a community without leaders emerging, you know? And then how do communities like this exist without tensions emerging?
Right.
I mean, I imagine that's something that would come up a lot.
There's certainly a lot of tensions. I think the tensions have to do with the fact that you're just sharing so much.
Mm-hmm.
They had a 6-word poem contest at Twin Oaks, and the my favorite entry was the poem was, "We share everything. Hey, that's mine." So there's definitely that kind of tension that's just a tension within the human soul, right?
Yeah.
of wanting to share but wanting to claim things. So that there's that. The other answer to your question is that they embody almost like this Plato's Republic sort of attitude towards leadership.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if leadership is something no one wants, but they take it on reluctantly for the good of the community. And so even when I was there, their board of leaders, as it were, wasn't even filled because, you know, people were very involved in the work, their work groups, and in very various different sects within the community. But there wasn't this sense of, I want to tell somebody else how to do something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have this, some people would think, dirty little secret that one of my favorite movies is The Village.
Right, The Village, somebody, yeah.
And, I mean, people either love that movie or hate it. I happen to love it. Did you think of that movie at all or look at that movie at all?
I hadn't thought about it until people started bringing it up to me.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh, gosh, it's been so long since I've seen that movie. But I need to go back and look at it now in terms of all of this.
So were these people who live in these communities that brought it up or just people who are interested in what you're writing about?
Yeah, people who've heard reviews of the book or
have
said, what about The Village?
Right. Yeah, it does sort of get remembered, you know, as just this horror movie and all that. But it really is about, you know, these people who go off into the woods to have a utopian community together. Now I've spoiled it for everybody who hasn't seen the movie.
It's a very old movie. So, you know. I mean, that's the interesting thing is most of the literature about utopia is dystopian. I mean, most of the great writing, like Cormac McCarthy's The Road, is dystopic. I think it's, or like that great film, Children of Men.
Mm, one of my favorites.
I think it's, you know, in some ways particularly in our fiction, we gravitate towards dystopia. I mean, maybe it's just boring writing about.
Well,
you know,
we like trouble. Right?
Yeah. So I thought, well, this is a piece of nonfiction, so I'll just try to, you know, write about these people who are, you know, the opposite of dystopic.
Yeah. Well, while you were driving around out there, I imagine you were listening to a lot of music. You're a great music lover. So what have you been listening to lately that you could recommend?
The thing I'm digging right now, and my wife is sick of hearing me play it while we cook dinner, is the new Red Hot Chili Peppers record.
Oh, yeah? I haven't heard that.
Yeah, I love it. Nobody plays bass like Flea.
Yeah. I'll have to check that out.
It's real catchy.
And what have you been reading?
I've been reading, I came late to it, but I'm loving it. Helen McDonald's H is for Hawk.
I just read it, yeah.
Yeah, and I saw it was on President Obama's summer reading list. And there's a great book of poetry I want to recommend by a guy. He's not well known. He's a California poet named Joseph Stroud. And he just had a book of new and selected poems come out, and they're very quiet and lyrical and meditative. And I've been reading those in the morning, and it's been real nice.
Are they sort of nature driven, or
a lot of it's nature driven? Some of it's I think he spent a lot of time in Vietnam, and some of it's sort of based on his travels.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll look for that, and I can't recommend H is for Hawk highly enough. I mean, it's a very dense, serious, dark read.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just beautiful.
The so beautifully written. And I like that she's so British that, you know, you're sort of, it's a language that defamiliarizes you from the English language, and you have to sort of think about these new words.
Yes. Look for that one after you buy Utopia Drive, the new book by Eric Reese. Well, this book, Utopia Drive, you focus on communities on the east of the Mississippi, I think was your definition, right?
Right.
Does that mean that you're going to do part two?
I don't think so.
You've learned all you need to learn.
I think I mean, you know, the West is so different. Yeah. And, you know, the thinking out West is so different. And I've never lived in the West. And so I just didn't trust myself to really understand what I was seeing in the West. And really, all of this utopian thinking started here in the East. So it makes sense. Mm-hmm. That I would do the book here in the East.
Right. Well, you know, let's just say you've written the definitive book about utopian communities.
There, you know, there's five more that have come out this year. It seems to be having a moment.
The zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being here with us, Eric. We appreciate you and all
it's
your good work.
It's always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Well, we're going to close the show with a song that seems appropriate right now due to everything that's been going on in the world. And we really need to hear this as we head into these last months dealing with this election. We'll get through it. Thanks for joining us here on WUKY for another episode of Hillbilly Salad. And until next time, be good to one another. Here's the Dixie Chicks.